All right, in Matthew chapter 6, I want to begin reading in verse 24, and I'll read down through verse 34. In fact, Randy, if you don't mind, you do a good job at that. If you would, please read that for us, 24 through 34.
Matthew 6, 24 through 34. No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth. For this reason I say to you, do not be worried about your life, as to what you will eat or what you will drink, nor for your body as to what you will put on. Is not life more than food, and the body more than clothing? Look at the birds of the air. They do not sow, nor reap, nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not worth much more than they? And who of you, by being worried, can add a single hour to his life? And why are you worried about clothing? Observe how the lilies of the field grow. They do not toil, nor do they spin. Yet I say to you that not even Solomon in all his glory clothed himself like one of these. But if God so clothed the grass of the field, which is alive today and tomorrow is thrown into the furnace, will he not much more clothe you, you of little faith? Do not worry then, saying, what will we eat, or what will we drink, or what will we wear for clothing? For the Gentiles eagerly seek all these things. For your heavenly Father knows that you need all these things. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. So do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will care for itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own.
Isn't that the truth? Thank you. In the reading of this text, it stands on its own, but it fits into a sermon that starts in the fifth chapter, the Sermon on the Mount. And all of these, in all of this context, we've noted several times that Jesus is identifying qualities and traits necessary to entrance into the kingdom. So that's the theme. What is it that's necessary to enter into the kingdom? And one of the things, brethren, I think, frankly, that we sometimes don't see, and certainly the world does not see, and that is that there are two different standards by which we live. Often people think there's just one way to live and everybody lives that way, and that's just not so. And Jesus is trying to draw the distinction between those who are the scribes and the Pharisees, the leaders among the Jews, who think that they are righteous, think that they're walking by the right standard, at the same time showing that these are not walking by the standard necessary to entrance into the kingdom. We noted in verse 20 of the fifth chapter that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, ye shall in no wise enter into the kingdom of heaven. And then he concludes the Sermon on the Mount. Lots of instances in between, but he concludes the Sermon on the Mount, Randy, and what you've referred to as your favorite Bible passage, Matthew 7:21. Not everyone that says unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter into the kingdom, but he that doeth the will of my Father who is in heaven. And then that's contrasted by those who thought they were, when in fact they were not. In fact, he said, what you're doing are works of lawlessness. It's works of iniquity. It's sinful, in other words, works without authority. Now, one of the things that we want to note on this lead-in chart is that Jesus, throughout the Sermon on the Mount, is talking about practicing your righteousness. It is a matter of doing things, not just what you believe, and it's not a matter of a pretense before other people. It's living with the right attitude that guides the right practice. And we've discussed that already in the Sermon on the Mount. Now, one of the things that I want to lead in with as well on our study tonight is to notice the contrast that has been set forth regarding where your mindset is. You cannot focus upon the treasures of this earth and the treasures of heaven at the same time. We noted that Jesus speaks at some length about the lamp of the body is the eye, and if the eye be single. In other words, we talked about the focus of your mind is single. You're looking for treasure in heaven. You're not focused upon the things of this earth, and that becomes a point that he's elaborated on already in the Sermon on the Mount. In fact, in the sixth chapter, beginning in verse 1, when he talks about such things as giving alms, such things as praying, such things as fasting. If you're looking at the things of this world, then you're looking to influence people. Influence friends and people. And that's not the objective here. If your mind is focused on God, then you're setting your mind on spiritual things with your efforts to please Him. Now, that serves as a lead-in, because when you look at verse 24, he says, "You cannot serve two masters. For you will either hate the one and love the other, or you'll hold to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon." Now, how many of us have seen folks, or perhaps we, have tried to do that? And we illustrated last week, as we concluded our study with the rich young ruler, prime example of one who's trying to do both. Here's a good man, both from a physical standpoint and a spiritual standpoint. You remember when Jesus enumerated the commandments, the young man said, "All these have I observed from my youth up." You've got to brag on him. Spiritually, he's a good man. From a physical standpoint, he has his youth, he has his wealth, he has power and prestige, and he's using it, it appears, in a very good way. He's interested in eternal life. Came to the master teacher to find out what to do. He receives the right answer, but he's trying to hold on to both worlds, and he can't do it. But he made a choice, didn't he? He went away sorrowful, for he had great riches. He made a choice. You cannot straddle the fence. Maybe you've heard the story about straddling the fence, about how the devil owns the fence. Yeah. Well, you can't do that. You're going to make a choice. Now, here is our problem. When we become anxious over the affairs of this life, how many of us have ever done that? That's not what we should be doing. Those things that Jesus is talking about in this Sermon on the Mount, winning friends and influencing enemies, having a standing before men. Well, we don't want to be hated, do we? I mean, it's kind of a natural context. You don't want everybody in the world to dislike you. We want folks to kind of like us a little bit. But you cannot serve God and the world at the same time. Can't do it. You're going to make a choice. Which one? And here's the problem that we sometimes have. Being anxious about the affairs of this life puts us into a bind. I have on the board that anxiety is evidence of a lack of faith in God. I want to put an exclamation mark beside of that. Because this audience that Jesus is speaking to, would you describe this audience as an audience that would just immediately acknowledge, "We do not have faith in God"? Who's he speaking to? Religious people. Yes. He's speaking to very religious people. People that believe in God. The multitudes of the Jews are listening to him. And these would never say, "No, I don't believe in God," or "I don't have faith in God." Now, there is a difference. These would not say that. But when we become so overburdened with the affairs of this life, that's what it becomes, a demonstration of a lack of faith in God. Now, we could just go on and on and on, listing passages necessitating faith. Hebrews 11, 6. Who can quote it for me? Jenny? "Without faith, it is impossible to please Him. For he that cometh to God must believe that He is," that He is "the rewarder of them that diligently seek Him." Thanks for all your help. Yeah, we got that. We must. You cannot please God without faith. And that's our go-to passage, isn't it? And when we look at the 23rd Psalm, what's the psalmist expressing? "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, thou art with..." What's he expressing throughout the whole psalm? That's right. He's confident in God. And so we go to these familiar passages to try to show somebody the necessity of faith. And then one that I have on the board that perhaps we've emphasized in more recent times than a long time ago. In Acts 27, the context deals with the shipwreck. And of course, Paul is on the ship, and the people are being fretful about dying from the storm. And what did Paul tell them that had appeared to him in the night? An angel of God had appeared to him in the night. What did the angel of God tell him? Everybody's going to be okay. Yeah. If you stay on the boat. And then what did Paul say? I believe God. Not I believe in God. Now here's where the rub comes, folks. I believe what he said. To the point that the seas can just do their thing and tear this boat all apart, but I'm not going to leave the boat because God said not leave the boat. And we won't perish if we won't leave the boat. So let the storms come. Now can you imagine? They've been on that boat for a long time. This shipwreck wasn't just an overnight incident. It's been a matter of over 2 weeks that shipwreck has been taking place. The storms have tossed it back and forth. And now it's run aground and the sea is about to break it apart. And Paul said, I believe what God said. I'm not going to get off the boat. And neither did anybody else. By this point in time, they're kind of beginning to believe Paul too. But what we want to note just here is that Jesus is not forbidding us being concerned about things. Let us underscore that in our minds. Bruce?
Can we go back over to Psalms 23?
Well, sure we can.
The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He made me lie down in green pasture.
Right.
He leadeth me beside the still waters.
Right.
He restored my soul. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk in the valley of death, I shall fear no evil. And thou art with me, and thy rod and thy staff shall comfort me. And thou preparest a table before me in the presence of my enemies. And
anointest my head with oil.
Anointest my head with oil, and the cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life. And I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Amen.
Well, that's right. When we look at this psalm, he's expressing complete dependence upon God. He is my shepherd. And the analogy of the sheep with the shepherd. The sheep is totally dependent upon the shepherd. The shepherd's job is to provide food, to provide water, to provide protection. Everything that the sheep needs is in the hand of the shepherd. It's his job.
That's how I see Paul.
Yes. But David says here, the Lord is my shepherd. I'm entirely dependent upon him. I believe what he says. And so consequently, I'm not going to doubt him. Now here's where the rub comes. Though we look at those passages and we're well aware of them, when it comes to the affairs of this life, the treasures of this world as it is, we sometimes worry about those things. We become anxious about those things. Now, in 1 Timothy chapter 5, in verse 8, we see that we have a responsibility to work. Point being, the man who does not provide for his own, he's denied the faith, and he's worse than an unbeliever. We must learn to work. The Old Testament prophet, in the book of Lamentations, I believe, Jenny, you've got your little pokey thing you sell me, if that's it. The passage says that a young person or that one is to learn the yoke in his youth. I believe that's in Lamentations. Learn to work. Now, learning to work that's an art in and of itself. You want to learn math? What do? You work at it. You find a math teacher, a math book, or you learn to do this. You learn to work. Now, it doesn't come altogether natural, does it? Those of you who have children, you know that child doesn't get up in the morning and say, oh boy, Dad, what are we going to do today? We're just going to look forward to a great day of hard work in the field. As soon as it becomes daylight, we'll go to the field after we get all the cows tended. Oh boy, what a wonderful day it is. Now, little Johnny just approaches us with that attitude, don't he? Yes. Thank you. Lamentations 3:27. Learn to bear the yoke in your youth. You learn to work. Now why? Because when you get older, you're going to have the responsibility of providing for yourself and your family. In fact, you're commanded to do that. You have to do that if you want to go to heaven. Now do we see that? Having established that point. If you don't do that, then you've denied the faith and you're worse than an unbeliever. Now, Noah, let me pick on you just a little bit. You and I were talking the other day about matters not just necessarily the labor that you do, but all of the bookwork and all of that sort of thing that goes with it. That's a part of it. Maybe that's not a very desirable part of it, but that's part of it, isn't it? Now, if you say, well, I'll do the labor end of it, But I don't like doing the bookwork, so I just won't do that. Your job gonna, or your work gonna succeed? Now let me ask you this. In view of our conversation, when it comes to some of the undesirable part of that job, you give some thought to that, some concern to that, because that's all got to be done right. You know that. It's not just a matter of the labor end of the thing. It's the bookwork part of it, too. They're your responsibilities to those who work for you. And all of that gets complicated. And no doubt, you give that considerable thought to make sure that you do everything that needs to be done. I know that. We've had that conversation, and you know that. But as we look at this passage and see what all is involved in that, Jesus is not saying in our text to not be anxious, to not give thought to things that are of major importance. You give thought to things, but the point is you think it through reasonably, rationally, logically, and try to arrive at a conclusion that is best, and then try not to worry yourself about it. Now, is that easy? Shake your head like this. No, that's not easy. That is hard. Now let me ask you another question, Jared. Here's what we're looking at. In Proverbs chapter 6, would you read for me, please? Beginning in verse 6 through verse 11. A very impressive passage. Cites for us an example that sometimes we don't spend much time watching. Proverbs chapter 6, beginning in verse 6, please.
Proverbs 6, 6 through 11. Provided your meat in the summer and gathered her food in the harvest. Along with thy sleep, O sluggard, one without rise out of thy sleep, yet a little sheep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep. So shall thy poverty come as one that traveleth, and thy want as an armed man.
Isn't that impressive? Isn't that impressive? Look at the ant. What do you always see the ant doing? Working, busy, working, working, working. Now, she has no chief, it says, no overseer, no ruler, but she works. And if you look further in the text, in verse 9, how long wilt thou sleep, O sluggard? Now, I'll give you a little personal history. Maybe some of you have had this same kind of history in your upcoming. When Dad came into our bedroom and said, breakfast's on the table, that means breakfast's on the table. Your feet better hit the floor. It's time to go. And if breakfast's on the table, that means it's hot. Dad didn't like his breakfast cold. And furthermore, when he said, it's time to go, get your feet on the floor, breakfast on the table, that means the day's starting, folks. And if he had to come back the second time, it was a little rougher. And you didn't even want to think about him coming back a third time. There wasn't none of this stuff. Say, 5 more minutes, Dad. No, No. Breakfast's on the table. Now. You know what that means? It's time to get up and get started. The day is starting. We're going to eat and then it's to the barn. That's the way that works. The day is starting. And when we get the cattle taken care of, then it's to the field. That's what we do every morning. That's just the way that works. Now, when you look at this passage and it says, how long wilt thou sleep, O sluggard? Well, you'd like to sleep in. Yeah. I've talked to a lot of folks who are my age and some that are older than I am, believe it or not. And some of those folks would say that if they piddle around with the guys and didn't get into the house or didn't go to bed until 11, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning, their dad would wake them up about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, regular time. Time to get started with the day. So what did they learn? If you're going to survive the day with Dad, you better get home and get into bed. Because Dad's not going to tolerate you being a sluggard. You're going to get up. Get the day started. Now that's exactly what he's saying. Yet a little sleep, yet a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep, so shall thy poverty come as a robber. And you want to sleep your life away? What's it going to make you? Poor. Pitiful. As Emma would say, just pitiful. Now, I said all that to say this. Jesus is not forbidding thought or concern. Yes, you've got to get up. You've got to go to work. That means there are responsibilities. You think about those things and you make decisions about those things. But here's the problem. The problem is where when those things become so much of a burden of concern that I'm not serving the Lord anymore. Now we've got an issue. And that issue, friend, is sin. That's what Jesus is talking about in this portion of the Sermon on the Mount. You see, when I'm not seeking first the kingdom of God anymore, that's not first place anymore. Oh, it's still important. But it's dropped down considerably. It's not first anymore. Now, if it's not first, how does God look upon it? That's right. He won't accept anything but first. Now, when we look at this, I want to read this with you. Jesus, I wanted to word it correctly. Jesus is forbidding our being overly concerned, full of care, troubled and upset with dread, so that we do not have peace of mind. We're not able to rest. All joy is taken out of living. Why? Because you're so worried about things that are on your mind. That spiritual things take a lesser place. And so we become blinded to the things that God has done for us. And what happens? We become so anxious over what we think we must do to provide the necessities of this life for us and our family that we forget about what God has already done for us. Jenny?
I get concerned sometimes when we talk about things like this, about anxiety or about depression or about things like that, where you say, well, it's just evidence of a lack of faith. There is a spot for that. There is some... maybe you do need to build up your faith. Maybe you do need to do things like this. But we can't discount the fact that there is a legitimate physical problem in certain cases.
Yes.
There's anxiety and depression, where there's neurological imbalance of some form and you need some form of therapy, or you need medication, or you need both. We can't always say, well, you just got to pray harder.
That don't work. That don't fix the problem. That don't fix the problem. Now, that may be a part of the problem, but that don't always fix the problem. And you said that just prior to me saying it, because that's absolutely right. There is an element. Now, I sometimes am hesitant. Some of you that I've been with recently, we've talked about this. Sometimes it is an expression of lack of faith. We just simply don't believe what God said. But sometimes there is an issue that involves our health. And I'm not a doctor. I don't pretend to be. But I know enough about this subject to know that sometimes the issue is not necessarily a lack of faith. It may be a medical problem for which we need to seek medical attention. There's all kinds of what some have called imbalances of chemicals and that sort of thing in one's body. And all of that plays a part. I'm not discounting that. But I don't believe that to be the subject that Jesus is dealing with. Jesus, in this passage, is talking about where my priorities are. He's not talking about neurological imbalances, you see. Now, there is a place for that, and that's right. And it's kind of like preaching on attendance. You know, often when you preach on attendance, somebody says, you know, but I've had the flu and I haven't been able to come. Well, I'm not talking to you. You see, that's where we go sometimes. There are legitimate reasons why I can't be here. If you're sick and you have something contagious, I don't want you to be here. Isn't that simple? But you see, the problem is, often, more often than not, that's not the issue. Yes, what?
To build on that, I really like the way that is said. Because if you took out evidence, if you took out that word, it didn't mean that anxiety.
Oh, yes.
I have faith in God, but it is evidence of it. So, and right, this is what Jesus is specifically speaking of. But even on that, that there is a part of it that does concern that portion of it.
Yes.
Even if there is some health issues or something like that, that's part of it too.
It is.
People that you know will have those imbalances or not, that's part of it. That you have faith that God has your back.
That's right.
They're going to work out, or, you know, those kind of things. And so I think that kind of ties into it. So I really appreciate it. that is worded that way.
Important word. Yes.
And we've heard it, I think we've heard it across a lot, that, oh, you're just not praying hard enough, like I said.
No. That don't always fix the problem. You see, it may be that that's the problem, but that's not always the problem. And so, yes, there is an end of the thing that is medical. And we'll just leave it at that, because I'm not educated on that realm of it. But I've seen in my lifetime and experienced enough of it to know that there is a legitimate end of it that needs to be in the medical category. But there and again, you know, when you are bad sick, again, been there, done that, what do you do about that? You pray. You pray to God about such things. You don't sit there and wring your hands and say, well, you know, I wish I'd get well. No, part of the answer to your prayer might be go to the doctor. Take the proper remedy to solve the problem. And so that is a part of it. Now, can God in His providence bless the body to respond in a positive way to the medication? Well, yes. You know, in the model prayer that Jesus gave here in Matthew chapter 6, as we've talked about before, give us this day our daily bread. All right, you get out here and you work a long, hard day. Can God bless the labor of your hands so that you have that bologna sandwich at night? Yes. Yes, He can. That's providence. That's not a miracle. Now, a miracle would be the bologna sandwich falling out of a tree, but you see, we're not seeking that. We're seeking God to bless what I'm doing to try to better things. And that's what we're talking about here, you see. And I think that's important. We can become so anxious that our spiritual life is just simply choked out. And here's a word that a friend of mine used to talk to me. Paralyzed. Now, when you're paralyzed, how would you describe that?
I ain't able to move.
You can't move.
You're immobile.
That's right. You can't move. Now, does God want us to be spiritually paralyzed? We're not growing. We're just there.
Just the opposite.
Just the opposite. You suppose that's why this passage is here? You see, I can become so anxious about things that I'm not doing what God wants me to do. So we're not talking now about a medical issue. We're talking about a problem that is a spiritual issue here in this context. Yes, James and then Bruce.
I wonder how many people were present at the Sermon on the Mount to hear this.
It says multitudes.
That may have also been present at the destruction of Jerusalem, who should have been and probably were thinking about these very things.
Yes, yes. Yes. Now, in this particular context, let it be noted that Jesus has, right on the heels of this previous discussion, He's talking about anxiety. But this previous discussion has to do with how you appear before men. How you gather the things that you think are necessary for your existence, where your treasure is. Do you see that this comment or this passage on anxiety is dealing with the same subject? It's the same thing. Where is your focus? What's important to you? That's what He's talking about. Now, as He continues this thought, I must hasten to say this. I thought it was an excellent comment made by William Barclay in his commentary on the Gospel of Matthew. He said, "The worry which wears out the mind wears out the body along with it. Worry affects a man's judgment, lessens his powers of decisions, and renders him progressively incapable of dealing with life." And then he goes on to say, "Let a man give his best to every situation." And here's where I really appreciated his thoughts. He cannot give more. Now, my dad was not a highly educated man, but I quoted him often. He had a certain level of smarts. And his expression was, "Do your best." And my dad had farmed many, many, many years with a team of mules. And he said, "For that's all a mule can do, is his best." Now, that analogy stands out in my mind. It probably don't mean as much to some of you as it does to me because of my background, but I understand what he was saying. He illustrated that. When we were farming, sometimes it was necessary to water some of our crop to back the wagon down into the pond. See, we didn't have an irrigation system like everybody else had an irrigation system. We backed the wagon down into the pond, and we would take 3 gallon buckets and we would fill up 52 gallon drums, barrels that we had on the wagon. Now, after you fill all those barrels up, can you imagine that wagon being a bit heavy? We had a tractor attached to it. But my dad told stories of how he had taken a team of mules to back that wagon down into the pond and loaded up with water to water the crops. And he said at one point he had that team of mules and he told them to go, and one did and the other balked. You know what it is for a mule to balk? Wouldn't pull, wouldn't go. Well, there's one mule over here doing the very best he can. Now, you know the pond down in the hole. And now you've backed it off down into muddy water. And one mule can't pull that load out. But he's doing the best he can. Thus, the background of my dad's expression. He finally persuaded the other one. I'll talk with you about that later. But together they pulled it out. But the point being, that's the best you can do. You just do your best. And now what do you do with the rest of it? You've got to give up. You pray about it. Give that one to God. Let Him take care of that. That's all you can do. Yep.
The good thing is that in these situations, God's the one that knows what's going on.
Yes.
And God's the one that and just going to be doing the judging, not us. So as Christians, the best that we can do is help and be as supportive as we can to the people that are in these tough situations that maybe we've never been in. And the more you do that, the less you see your problems.
Yes, yes, yes. Walk a mile in the other fellow's shoes, as the expression goes. That's right. Now here we are. Colossians chapter 3, beginning in verse 1. Dave, would you do some reading for me, please? 1 through 14. Colossians chapter 3, 1 through 14.
1 through 14, Colossians chapter 3. Therefore, if you have been raised up with Christ, keep seeking the things above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Set your mind on the things above, not on the things that are on the earth. For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is our life, is revealed, then you also will be revealed with Him in glory. Therefore, consider the members of your earthly body as dead to immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and greed, which amounts to idolatry. For it is because of these things that the wrath of God will come upon the sons of disobedience, and in them you also once walked when you were living in them. But now you also put them all aside, anger, wrath, malice, slander, and abusive speech from your mouth. Do not lie to one another, since you laid aside the old self with its evil practices, and have put on the new self, who, being renewed to a true knowledge according to the image of the one who created him, a renewal in which there is no distinction between Greek and Jew, circumcised and uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave and freeman, but Christ is all and in all. So, as those who have been chosen of God, holy and beloved, put on a heart of compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience, bearing with one another, forgiving each other, whoever has a complaint against anyone, just as the Lord forgave you, so also should you. Beyond all these things, put on love, which is the perfect bond of unity.
Oh, what a wonderful passage. We could talk on this passage all night long. But I want you to see the two standards that is recognized in this passage. Put off and put on. You find these lists all over the New Testament. Don't do this, do this. And this contrast, it just occurs over and over again. But where does it come from? What's important to you? Seek the things that are above. That's in the Sermon on the Mount, isn't it? Seek the things that are above. Set your mind on the things that are above, not upon the things that are upon this earth. Now, do we see how that our attitude, boy, that just means everything. Your attitude, what's the most important thing to you? What governs every decision that you make? One thing, what is it?
Serving God.
What does God say about this? Now, the person that does not know what God has to say about this, how does he make his decisions?
Serving self.
It's serving self. That's right. And do we not see how badly handicapped we are when we don't know what God says? As you look at this passage, notice the emphasis placed upon the renewing of your mind, verse 10. Set your mind, verse 2. If you don't know what God says, how then can you possibly make the decisions that please Him when you don't know what pleases Him? I hammer and hammer and hammer, I know a lot, on attendance to Bible classes and coming to worship and that sort of thing. But friend, if we are not converted to Christ to set our mind on these things, then harping about attendance don't mean a thing. When we face temptations, we don't know what God wants us to do, because all along the way, we've not used the resource book to train our mind with proper information. And so consequently, we make mistakes. How'd you like me doing brain surgery on you, Randy? Why? Well, you're messing up my illustration. You do know that.
Because
I can't do that. That's right. You want to talk to somebody that's knowledgeable about such things. And how does that person become knowledgeable? You hope he's gone to school. You don't want to think that this is the first time he's ever done that, you see. First time he's ever been inside of anybody's head, one way or another, you see. You want somebody that has set their mind on that, at least for enough time to learn what they're doing. Now, if you want to know how to resolve the problems, the temptations, the difficulties, the adversities, and make proper decisions in life, you must know what God says. Now, don't wait till you're right in the midst of a problem to say, I wonder what the Bible has to say about this. You see, it's a little late then to start expressing an interest, isn't it? You need to know what it says before you get into the midst of the situation, because then you will know what to do, what decisions to make. And that's what Jesus is teaching in the Sermon on the Mount. You don't need to worry about these things. Paul, writing to the Philippians, made this interesting point. He said, for many walk, of whom I told you often and now tell you, even weeping, that they are the enemies of the cross of Christ, whose end is perdition, whose God is the belly, whose glory is in their shame, who mind earthly things. Their mind is not properly set. Now, all of you, at one point or the other, we've had to witness those that we love make just terrible, terrible decisions. And you know, before they ever start down that path, you know exactly where that path leads. Maybe you've traveled it before. And you can talk your little heart out, and sometimes they just won't listen. And you just watch them like a train wreck. You know what's happening. You know what's coming. Now here's Paul, right? Me, I told you about this. I told you and cried about it. Because there's a lot of folks that are traveling that way that's going to lead to a train wreck. And I see it coming. You know why? Because they're not minding the proper things. Their point of emphasis in their life is the wrong place. And they're not going to make right decisions. And they've become an enemy of the cross of Christ. Now you think Paul didn't know what, not only what he was talking about, but perhaps even who. Put a name on that. That's just how serious it is. Now, when we become anxious about the things of this life, that becomes, one, as you said, evidence of a lack of faith in God. Now, how many of us have traveled the path where a loved one got sick? We've been there. Maybe all of us have not, but some of us have known people whose circumstance in life was a child got sick. And maybe even passed from this life. I knew of a lady one time who made the comment that she could not serve the Lord anymore. She couldn't pray to the Lord anymore because her child got sick. And she said, I prayed and prayed and prayed, and my baby died. She said, I just can't talk to the Lord anymore. Now here's my question, brethren. Where did God ever promise you that you won't be tempted? Where did He promise you that a loved one won't get sick and die, even perhaps a child? And you may be sitting there and somebody you love so, so dear, you just watch their bodies crumble and it breaks your heart. Not a thing in this world. You could do more than what you're doing. Do you forsake the Lord about that? Say, I can't talk to the Lord anymore. You see, you've reached a point where you said, I don't believe what God said, but the problem is you're attributing to God something that He didn't say. He never said that. You ever been guilty of that? He never said that the loved one won't get sick or that you won't have adversity. He never said that. But I think, brethren, we completely missed the boat when we failed to read what He did say. What did He promise? You can read that. What did He promise? I won't ever leave you. I won't ever fail you. I won't ever forsake you. Now you can take that to the bank. The Lord said that. Now the question is, as Paul said to those folks on the ship, I believe God. Do you? I won't ever leave you. See? Bruce, I missed you a while ago. I'll get you. Go ahead. I think you were up first, then I'll get back. One of the other. Draw straws.
Well, I'm rescued. When you look at Colossians, where we were at, it seems as He's talking to individuals. But then now when you look at in Philippians, it seems like He's talking to the whole congregation and come together. We need to come together and we need to be in one mind.
Yeah.
And now we need to be in one mind and we need to take care of each other.
Well, that's right. But the application, though it may be individual, it's for each individual in the congregation.
Yeah.
And it will result in unity. Yeah. Yeah. Now, I won't ever fail you. I won't ever leave you. I won't forsake you. Let's look at what else He said again in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 7. Dave, I'm sorry.
He's mad because I ran the bell.
I know it. I felt about tripping you, but anyway.
You know, sometimes when you look at this, sometimes I don't think a lot of people understand where God is when it comes to things like with loved ones who, for example, when Eve and I were pretty young, well, I'm back, there was a couple that we knew very well, and the husband had cancer, and he had a lot of pain and suffering and everything, and a lot of times people would pray for the hands ministering unto him, to watch over him, to ease his pain. That was one thing. Well, he ended up passing away. I looked at it like, well, God answered your prayer because we asked for him to ease his pain. He's no longer in pain, but some folks won't see it like that.
That's true. And sometimes, you know, with my mom and my dad, both of them, you see them deteriorate to a point and you're not exactly sure what to pray. And what do you pray? You pray that God knows what's best and He'll do what's best. And that's where that is. Now, most of us in this class, we've traveled that path. We know what that is. Now, when we look at what He has said in Matthew chapter 7, again in the Sermon on the Mount, pick up the reading there beginning in verse 7. He said, ask and it shall be given you. Seek and ye shall find. Knock and it shall be opened unto you. For everyone that asketh receiveth, and he that seeketh findeth, and to him that knocketh it shall be opened. Or what man is there of you who, if his son shall ask him for a loaf, will give him a stone? Or if he shall ask for a fish, will give him a serpent? If ye then, being evil, know how to give good gifts unto your children, how much more shall your Father, who is in heaven, give good things unto them that ask Him? Notice the emphasis upon your Father. You, as fathers, you know how to give the things that your children need. Do you think I don't know? Or that I don't care? Now, what did James tell us in James chapter 4 about sometimes why we may pray, but we don't get what we're asking for? We've got our motives in the wrong place. Verse 2, you lust and have not, you kill and covet and cannot obtain, you fight and war and have not, because you ask not, you ask and receive not, because you ask amiss, that you may spend it in your pleasures. Ye adulteresses, know ye not that the friendship of the world is enmity with God? Do you not see that James and the Lord are preaching the same sermon outline? When he says, lay not up for yourselves treasures upon the earth where moth and rust consume, where thieves break through and steal. That's the very same thing that James is saying. He says, you don't ask, and then when you do ask, you ask to consume it on your own lust. Now here's the problem. The problem is, your aim is off. Your mind is not single. You're not focused on the things that are above. In fact, James tells us in James chapter 1 and verse 2, count it all joy, my brethren, when ye fall into manifold temptations, knowing that the proving of your faith worketh patience, and let patience have its perfect work, that ye may be perfect and entire, lacking in nothing. Now let's apply that. When Paul was patient during the period of imprisonment, the shipwreck on the way to Rome to be imprisoned where he was for 2 years, do you think with the experience in Jerusalem and the captain's name, Sergius Paulus? Claudius Lysias. Thank you, Jenny. Since we stumbled over that, I'll never get it right again. But Claudius Lysias. Do you think that the events that resulted in Paul's being delivered safely to Rome caused him then to maybe be anxious about what's going to happen to him at Rome? You read what we call the prison epistles, you get that impression. He said, rejoice in the Lord. And again, I say rejoice. Let your forbearance be made known. And nothing be anxious. Well, why did Paul have the right to say that? Look at what he'd been through. The plot to kill him in Jerusalem. The deliverance by Claudius Lysias. The shipwreck and nobody died. I believe God. Now he's in prison for 2 years. You think he was worried about what was going to happen? No. In nothing be anxious. You're trying to tell me I got to quit? Get off that butt. All right. Well, the point being, it's difficult to count it all joy right in the midst of some real hard times. But when you've experienced that, successfully endured it, when you come out on the other side and then you face it again, now what? You're going to wring your hands and worry and be anxious about what you think God might do?
It produces endurance.
Confidence, you see. And that's where we are. All right. Well, we didn't quite finish this evening.